Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
It's just gone 6 minutes after 6 o'clock on this 28th day of July. Hello and welcome to the SAFM Market Update. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jimmy Moyaha this evening. Here's what you can look forward to. In a few moments, we speak to Chantel Marks, Head of Investment Research and Content at F&B Wealth and Investments, on how the markets fared today at least. We also take a look at results for the 6 months ending June 30 of Kumba Iron Ore. We explore the defense economy and how this can bolster industrialization or reindustrialization in South Africa. And in our AgriFocus feature, we take a look at sugar imports, which are stifling local growers.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
Chantel Marks is Head of Investment Research and Content at F&B Wealth and Investments. Chantel, thank you very much. Always a pleasure. Let's start with financials. Boxer out with a trading update for the 20 weeks ended 19 July. The share price down 1.3%, though. What stood out for you?
Well, we did see a slowing down in sales growth in this specific reporting period. And a lot of that had to do with price deflation. So even though we might be at the tills and we feel like everything is getting more expensive, a lot of these retailers are competing on price. And retailers like Boxer, with a heavy weighting towards maize and flour products, saw those commodity prices come under quite a bit of pressure, and they gave those savings back to their consumers. Mm. What was quite positive, though, was that volume growth was still very strong, which tells us that they are still managing to see that momentum move forward, though.
Maybe let's stay on that momentum, because Boxer increased its market share and they will be opening up more stores. Is this reflective of consumer sentiment?
Well, I think it's part of Boxer's broader strategy of increasing its footprint over time. I think what we've seen over the last few years is that discount and value retail really works in the South African setup. But if you think about it relative to overall retail, formal retail, even in that space, is still quite low relative to the informal sector. So that's really where this business, along with competitors like YouSave, will be setting their sights, really bringing formal retail to communities that have been kind of overlooked over the last 20, 30 years, and perhaps bringing them better savings and better deals in the process.
Just staying on retail before we move to Canal Plus, the Foschini Group, down today, up tomorrow, that share price gaining 3.5%. How should we understand that move?
Well, the Foschini Group has been under pressure over the last couple of years. It's really a confluence of factors. So I think I'd start with the non-South African factors, which really is a very tough UK retail environment and a really tough Australian retail environment, because the Foschini Group operates in those geographies as well. And then on the South African front, you do have competition in the form of Chinese imports via Shein and Temu, really competing with them on the home front and on the clothing front. And then finally, you also are competing for share of wallet with gambling. It's online gambling has really picked up over the last few years. But I mean, the Foschini Group is trading as low as it has in a very, very long time. So the reason why the share price is bouncing up and down is because when the share price gets this low, investors are maybe nibbling a little bit and thinking that perhaps a recovery longer term could be on the cards and that this could be a really good entry point. And then on the flip side, you have people frustrated with having been invested in Foschini, perhaps looking to take profit as soon as that stock price starts bouncing a little bit.
Sure. I'd like to just explore online gambling, what you just mentioned now. Are we looking at, I don't know if why is actually a question, but are we finding that people are maybe trying to supplement their income with online gambling? What are some of the drivers of the high levels that we're seeing in the country, I guess? Do we know?
Yeah, well, I do think there's an element of gamification involved in online gambling. So when the excitement, I think, around it is palpable, and you can get drawn into it pretty quickly, and then you kind of get trapped in that cycle, or you're trying to win back losses. We also have a very high unemployment rate in South Africa, so I think a lot of particularly younger individuals will look towards online gambling as a potential to make something more out of what they are actually able to extract out of this economy. And then it's very much unregulated to a certain extent. So we do have some regulation in terms of online gambling, but there are so many illegal sites involved as well, and they draw you in. So it's a confluence of factors, really, but something that I think from a societal perspective, we really need to address.
Fair enough. Let's take a look at Canal Plus. It would seem that in the 6 months ending June 30, the disposal of Showmax literally paid off.
Yeah, I think it would have had a small impact, though. I think broadly speaking, there were other drivers of a really solid result. Mm-hmm. I mean, the combination of MultiChoice and Canal Plus was always going to be quite complicated, but it seems as if it is gaining traction, and the synergy gains, the savings that they promised, is starting to come through. And what's also helped Canal Plus and MultiChoice during this period is really strong subscriber additions. Now, on the MultiChoice front, I am still a little bit, I'm not 100% convinced that those subscriber additions will necessarily be sticky, because we did have a very busy sporting calendar, and that could have complemented these numbers during this specific period. But I mean, MultiChoice is number one in sports in South Africa. They invest heavily in local content. Yeah. We know South Africans love watching local. So there's still a lot to play for in this space. And I think that this result shows that MultiChoice and Canal Plus together seem to be moving in the right direction and executing on what they said they were going to execute on when they first decided to merge.
Fair enough. You've sort of answered my second question, because I was looking at this and I was thinking, now the trick is continuing this momentum, because we live in different times now, especially with the consumption of content.
Yeah, but I do think, I mean, South Africans, and I really think it's actually a global phenomenon. People love watching local stories. They like knowing the characters in a deeper way. So it's different consuming local content than it is consuming Hollywood content, for example. And I think what both these businesses do very well is that they invest in the film industry, both in France, in the broader African continent, and as well as in South Africa. And as long as they keep doing that, I think that that competitive advantage is still there. And then they need to figure out how to compete with the streaming guys, and the streaming guys who have excellent platforms that they're working with. Because I mean, I'm sure that you've used the DStv Now app, and it just doesn't compete at this point in time. So maybe it's better in France for Canal Plus, but I think there's certainly more work to be done over here.
Definitely. What's driving the rand in the positive? We are now trading 16.66 to the US dollar.
Yeah, so I do think that we've had a kind of a better day from an oil market perspective. Well, another good day from an oil market perspective, and that would have released some pressure in terms of trade concerns that the rand would have struggled with last week, for example. But broadly speaking, a weak US dollar is also having a positive impact. Going into the Federal Reserve meeting tomorrow, the expectation is still that they're going to keep rates on hold. And if you think about other central banks globally, most of them have hiked rates. Even though we had a surprise hold from the South African Reserve Bank, we're still ahead of the curve relative to the Fed. And that puts downward pressure on that US dollar.
Got you. Resources, risk off there. Tungela, Implats, Karoo, Glencore, Exxaro, Northam, Valterra, which is coming out with their update tomorrow, AngloGold all down today. How should we interpret this?
Yeah, it's actually quite interesting. I think the golds and the PGMs probably kind of getting sold off along with a kind of a relaxation in terms of the overall geopolitical risk story that we are seeing playing out in the Middle East right now. I think it's too soon to call anything a trend or anything permanent. And then when we look at the rest of the broader complex, perhaps that that rout from the AI stocks also ultimately impacting some of the diversified miners as well. Because if you think about what actually drove Anglo's BHP Glencore over the last few months, it really was that exposure to copper, exposure to iron ore, and that in turn benefiting from the AI build out. And today, globally, we are seeing a lot of concern around that AI build out and the
Yeah.
sustainability of the investments there.
Thank you so much, Chantel. Chantel Marks is Head of Investment Research and Content at FNB Wealth and Investments.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
For decades, developed market government bonds have been the cornerstone of global fixed income portfolios. But with government debt levels rising and fiscal deficits widening, are long-held assumptions about sovereign debt being challenged? Tomorrow evening at 6:45, Thalia Patosis, portfolio manager at Allan Gray, joins SAFM Market Update to discuss why developed market borrowing costs are under pressure and explore where long-term investors are finding value in the global fixed income universe. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Weaker iron ore prices, port disruptions and acts of nature weighed down Kumba Iron Ore's first half profits. Net income during the first 6 months of 2026 was 4.1 billion rand compared with 7.1 billion rand a year earlier. The miner declared an interim dividend of 7.90 rand per share, some 2.5 billion rand, following a 41% decline in headline earnings to 13.24 rand a share. In spite of a tough operating environment though, the Anglo-American unit delivered an EBITDA margin of 35% and production that has been fatality-free. We speak now to Kumba Iron Ore CEO Mpumi Zikalala. Ma Zikalala, thank you very much for your time this evening. So a week ago today, you issued a trading statement anticipating a profit drop. How would you characterize the first half performance?
Hi, Dudu, and thank you for having me. So I've actually characterized it as resilient, considering all the external pressures that you've spoken about. So we sell our production in dollars. So when you convert that back into rands, we clearly, with the 11% strengthening of the rand, so a reduction in our sales. Secondly, our sales volumes actually dropped slightly, you know, and that was as a result of the additional 10 days of maintenance shut work that was done on the logistics line. I have to say that we supported this simply because it does essentially mean that we'll see further improvements in the logistics space in future. And then last but definitely not least, the war in the Middle East did mean that clearly we were under pressure just from an input price perspective linked to predominantly diesel, as well as ammonia that goes towards explosives. And then you also spoke about the rain. And the reason why I fundamentally characterized our results as being resilient is simply because when you look across the board, you know, our production was marginally lower, even with the significant levels of rain that we saw. We were fatality free, which is critical for us because keeping our people safe is key. And then the drop in earnings, I mean, if you look at it, 96% of that was actually linked to external factors.
You mentioned the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and how it has had an impact on operations. How material has expenditure on petroleum products and freight rates been?
So a couple of things on this. So one is we looked at fuel from an availability perspective, and I was very pleased when our supply chain and finance teams were able to ensure that we were not going to be impacted as a result of this. And then secondly, diesel is one of our key cost drivers together with ammonia, and we have seen the impact. I guess fundamentally the question is, what will be the impact on a go-forward basis? And that clearly depends on how long it will take for the war to finally be over. The last thing that impacted us is that when we sell, there's a freight element that's linked to our cargo going to our customers, be it from a China, Europe, Japan, South, and South Korea perspective. And we have seen an increase in the freight rates by virtue of the increase in fuel prices as well.
I'd like for us to go back to the acts of nature that you briefly touched on. We understand this was the heaviest regional rainfall since 1918. Just talk to our listeners rather about the operations that were impacted and what happened to production there.
Yeah. So we had our normal rains between, you know, January to March, and that's the norm. And our teams were actually prepared and we continued running our operations. And then the rains continued into April and May. And to what you said, this was the highest ever recorded at Kolomela since 1918, and at Sishen, the highest ever recorded since 1963. So what we did essentially have is that we had flooding in the various parts of our business. But what I'm pleased with is that our teams actually remained focused and we were still able to declare fatality-free production during this period. And then if you just fundamentally look at the impact, we're still able to talk about a 4% improvement in our waste mining, even with the heavy rains. Clearly, we would have wanted to see more than this. And then from a production perspective, we did talk about the slight drop in production. Mm-hmm. And clearly, this is also linked to the rains. So our teams just remained focused. And post the rains, we focused on getting back to stability in terms of our operations.
You also declared a dividend of 2.5 billion rand, 60% of headline earnings against a payout policy of 50 to 75% of earnings. What should this tell us?
This should give an indication that as Kumba, we actually deliver on our promises. As you said, our dividend policy calls for the 50 to 75% of our payout ratio. And that's exactly what we fundamentally did. As we were thinking about the dividend, we were mindful of a couple of things. Firstly, we are busy with a massive capital investment program, and that's linked to our ultra-high dense medium separation project, as well as the recapitalization of our fleet. And this is critical for us because it's the investment into the future of our business. And that will essentially result in elevated levels of capital over the next couple of years. The other thing that we considered was just fundamentally where the world is right now with all the volatility and the levels of uncertainty. We don't know when the war in the Middle East will finally be over. And as a result, we believe that we were, I guess, balanced in terms of what it is that we paid from a dividend perspective and responsible.
You realized an export price that is above the benchmark in spite of industry challenges. That is what, $90 per wet metric ton. What does that speak to?
This was indeed 8% above the benchmark, and it speaks to the quality of our product. So what we look at is that we look at the index itself, and then by virtue of the iron content within our product, this was sitting at 63.6%. We actually earn a premium. And then we earn an additional premium that's linked to the fact that we have a naturally formed product called lump. And this is very good for the blast furnaces. And we earn an additional premium. And this 8% above the benchmark is something that we value as a business. And with the introduction of the new technology of ultra-high dense medium separation, we will actually see more premiums coming through. I do want to compare this to what others have seen. Mm-hmm. So if you look at Australia in the Pilbara, they actually have reduced the quality of their material, moving from the 62 to the 61 to the 61 index. And for us, we see this as a massive element that we need to continue looking at in order to differentiate ourselves as a business.
You've mentioned the UHDMS project at the Sishen mine here in South Africa. Is implementation on track? What's the business case of this technology?
So firstly, this is a game changer for us. It's a project which looks at an implementation of ultra-high dense medium separation technology, which will fundamentally mean that we'll be able to reduce the cutoff grade of the material that goes into our plant, which means that material that would typically go into the waste stream will go into the plant. And as a result, we will be able to reduce the amount of waste that we mine and see a benefit from an operating cost perspective. On the other end, you would think that if you feed lower grade material, that you would produce product that is essentially characterized by lower qualities. What's impressive for us is that even with that, we'll see an improvement in our qualities, and that will see us earning more premiums linked to the element that we've just spoken above, which is the average realized export price above the benchmark. So one is, it's a fundamental game changer for us. It is an 11.2 billion rand project that is converting our current dense medium separation plants into ultra high dense medium separation. And this year is a critical year for us. So in the second half, starting, you know, in August, the second week of August, we'll actually stop this plant from running as we conduct critical materials handling tie-in. And I'm excited if I just look at the level of preparations that has been done by our teams. So looking forward to essentially a second half where we'll connect and then continue with the investment simply because of the benefits that this will yield for us.
It sounds like there's no slowing down in spite of these external conditions. Thank you very much, Mazikalala, for your time this evening. Mpumi Zikalala is Kumba Iron Ore CEO.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
It's 27 minutes after 6 o'clock. Hello again, and thank you very much for staying with us. So the SADC Industrialization Week is currently underway in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal, a platform dedicated to advancing industrialization, regional integration, investment promotion, and economic transformation within the Southern African Development Community. We're now joined by Dr. Mlungi Sicele, Director General at the Department of Science, Technology, and Innovation, for more. Thank you very much, Doc, for your time this evening. Maybe for the purposes of this discussion, I'd like for us to rely on the SADC Industrialization Strategy and Roadmap of 2015 to 2063. In 2015, the value of intra-SADC trade was 17% of total SADC trade. Where do we sit today in assessing how far we've come as a region?
Thank you very much to you and your listeners for giving us this opportunity to share. We were informed yesterday by the leaders, both the chair of Business Council and the ministers, that we are not doing well as the region. You know, for instance, if you you just take manufacturing as a sector that we used to do so well a few years ago, we have declined. Now, the main message that was being communicated to the plenary as well as the commission is that SADC is not in a good space in all areas, whether you talk about trade, you're talking about innovation, you're talking about social services. We're just not in a good space, and therefore it's important to think about the future of SADC. We think about the role that industrialization will play. But those of us who are from the Department of Science, Technology and Innovation, and through our minister yesterday, we argued, and it was generally accepted, that innovation and industrialization can't be separated. They are the twins, right? So you've got to drive an innovation-led industrialization, and you've got to mobilize all the necessary stakeholders, whether you're talking about the private sector, you're talking about government, you're talking about society, the academia. You have to mobilize all who can play a big role. And there are certain strategic areas that were being discussed, such as critical minerals, pharmaceuticals, mineral beneficiation. But we also talk about food security and other challenges that are confronting logistics, transport, and the need. I mean, today we were, for instance, told that you know, some trucks, if, you know, when they drive to, it takes them 6 kilometers per hour to, you know, when they drive to Zambia. It's such a challenge that you need to ramp up. You can't have situations where the mode of transport is so low, so slow, right? So, I mean, we are facing challenges, but there are opportunities if leadership, quality leadership is, and the willingness by all parties concerned is secured.
Would that be where the problem lies when you, with this honest assessment that we have not moved the dial as a region? We are not doing well. In fact, it's a grim assessment, some would argue. Why?
Well, there are many reasons, but again, our systems, our processes, our regulations are not harmonized. So let alone the fact that there's uneven development within SADC, and we know, I mean, South Africa, relatively speaking, is advanced as compared to, but there are some competences lying elsewhere in the region. So part of what we need to do is to make sure that we create a conducive environment to do proper trade, to do proper innovations, and to build the necessary capabilities that the region needs, to build skills, right? Because without skills, without, you know, the necessary infrastructure, without having harmonized policies and regulations, it's quite difficult to move ahead. And that's why through this gathering here, we were exploring all those different dimensions and asking ourselves, what should we do better to improve the regional integration? But at least as a start, people were all understanding and committed towards an integrated industrialization processes in the region if we were to make progress. So that regional economic integration is key, and industrialization can play a big role. We're all agreeing. But of course, you know, some will say you then need to make sure that you have the necessary finance models, the business. Some business people are saying we need to make sure there is policy certainty, the regulations are in right places, you've got skills, you remove all trade barriers and so forth. But it's also about how we need to work together as a region, and appreciating that a single country can't really on its own deliver and achieve whatever economic objectives that it's setting in light of the geopolitical dynamics. We need each other as a region to stand a better chance, to create scale, to create the necessary market that can enable us, even some of our products, to be able to move. But we must also ensure sovereignty of critical technologies that are so important, and use that as a strength to leverage for the benefit of the region.
Thank you very much, Doc, for your contribution this evening. Dr. Mlungisi Cele is Director General in the Department of Science, Technology and Innovation.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now, what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do. Even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system is kinda dear makar. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
Let's focus on to this now. Another step has been taken in the realization of trade and financial integration in the Southern African development community. The Angolan Kwanza is now formally a settlement currency in the SADC real-time growth settlement system. There are currently 15 countries participating in the system. Arif Ismail is head of National Payment System at the South African Reserve Bank, and he joins us now for more. Thank you very much, Mr. Ismail, for your time this evening. So let's start with an introduction of the SADC RTGS system to our listeners. What is it and how does it work?
Yeah, of course, Dirizile. So very simply, if you're a commercial bank sitting in any of the 15 countries and you need to make a payment to another country, let's say between South Africa and Tanzania, as an example, then you will go through the system. You click pay, and pretty much the SADC RTGS is the system where the funds get moved between one country's bank and another. So it's, you can think of it as the plumbing, the core engine that makes transactions in the region possible.
Aha. And every engine needs a little bit of oil every now and then. So what's the competitive advantage, I guess, of this system? Why is it so important?
Yes, I think it's important, and I'm going to bring it closer to onboarding the Angolan Kwanza.
Right.
So you can imagine a trader selling goods and services in Angola, and today, in order for them to get settled, they'll either invoice in a different currency, right? Whether that's a dollar or rand, etc. Tomorrow, what they could do is invoice in Kwanza. And as long as they've got a counterparty in Namibia that says, yes, sure, I'm willing to pay you, click, and it happens. There's no need for a third currency, right? Mm. And that's how we oil, the trade and transactions in the region, and in particular for the Kwanza now.
I appreciate that, because what I'm ultimately hearing also is that it is cost effective. I note that the Kwanza is the second settlement currency to be introduced in the SADC RTGS system. There are currently 15, as you noted, countries participating in the system. Does that translate to 15 currencies, or is it just 15 countries? I'm trying to reconcile the Kwanza being the second settlement currency versus the 15 countries participating in the system.
Yeah, so I strip it down a little and say, look, for four of the countries, for example, South Africa, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, they form part of the common monetary area, and therefore rand settlement is the kind of currency that those countries will go with. But for the remaining countries, certainly the idea from the Committee of Central Bank Governors of the 15 countries is to onboard these currencies over time, right? And I'll make it even more practical and say, you can think that we now have amongst the 15 countries, 8 countries that have volunteered to interconnect their faster payment systems. So for those 8 countries, CMA, can you still hear me?
Yes, please. Yes, please, we can.
For the CMA, plus the other 4 countries, you will see that potentially by next year, we will push to onboard, those particular currencies. So the short answer is yes. The intention here is to be able to onboard currencies that serve the region, right?
Some of those other currencies we see is the Botswana Pula also in due course. Just out of curiosity, how many transactions in a month are we seeing being processed?
So let me give it to you at a more macro level.
Okay.
So I'll kind of round it up to the aggregate over the last 13 years. Maybe that will give you a big macro sense, right? Mm-hmm. So over the last 13 years, the SADC RTGS has been running. Of course, the rand has been the only settlement currency. So transactions only happen in rand. But the kind of volumes and values we're talking about is about 7 million that's happened so far. But the value is in excess of 18 trillion rand. So, you know, you could imagine that, you know, often the volumes might be lower, mm-hmm. but the values typically, you know, tend to be quite high.
Ah, here's to 13 more years and beyond. And I guess this development sort of answers the question, because we had an interview just now with a representative from the Department of Science and Innovation, and they're having a SADC Industrialization Week, and the assessment in the room is that we haven't moved the needle as a development community. But this actually speaks to some of the good stories that we do need to actually tell about some progress that we are making. Thank you very much, Mr. Ishmael, for your time this evening. Arif Ishmael is Head of National Payment System at the South African Reserve Bank.
You are listening to the Market Update on SAFM.
The recently concluded defense industry Lekgotla has reiterated the importance of building sovereign industrial capability and preserving strategic defense technologies, among other measures, in South Africa. Now, a country's defense industry lays a solid foundation for a nation to enhance its defense capabilities against internal and external threats, among a swathe of other benefits. Daniel du Plessis is president of Africa Milcor. He joins us now on the line to speak about the country's defense economy acting as a catalyst for reindustrialization. Thank you very much, Daniel. In order to get there, maybe let's start with understanding the country's defense industry. How would you characterize it?
So the South Africa's defense industry is actually quite robust, and many of the countries around the globe actually rely on defense technologies that originate from South Africa. We have a long history of a robust industry that has been known for advancements and major technological breakthroughs implemented in defense and security clusters globally. And a lot of the export markets at this moment is the sole supply and the sole reason that this industry still exists. So as you mentioned during the Lekgotla, we explored some ideas of how we can maximize this benefit and still keep the advancements of new technologies that leads to industrialization, creating high-value jobs, and among other things, also a spin-off in dual-use technologies for different civil use alive and well, with the fiscus currently not being able to accommodate that whole thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Who are the main players, and are they singing from the same hymn book, or are we responding to individual mandates? Because you've got the public and you've got the private sectors very much active in this industry.
So as for the main players, I mean, I'm also working for one of the companies, so I can't speak on that note. But what I can say is that I think it's a coherent response from both public and private entities that are calling out for essentially advancements and government support to increase export flexibility and increase export markets, for government's assistance in marketing the South African defense industry as a whole, not just private companies or individual companies, to the outside market, specifically on the African continent, where we have quite a strong foothold as an industry. And then therefore driving an economic growth and creation of new jobs and unemployment issues.
If we have a robust industry where countries around the world rely on us for supplies, is it an incorrect assumption to say, well, why are we talking about industrialization? That means we already have an industrial base in place. Or is that a misplaced assumption?
Somewhat misplaced. I think one of the key assumptions are that the South African defense industry has for a long time been reliant on local consumption, i.e. the South African National Defense Force. And a lot of the economic driving factors meant that as the money gets spent from the fiscus in equipping the SANDF, these companies thrived, and the sub-suppliers or sub-companies that supply these major prime companies in the defense industry also did quite well and were able to employ quite a lot of people. But over the last two or so decades, the fiscus has declined dramatically in terms of spending on the SANDF in general, and therefore companies have had to make the transition from a local consumer or local supplier towards an export or international supplier. And many of the companies, although they have very advanced technologies and capabilities, either failed in that transition period, couldn't jump to an export market, had little to no exposure, or didn't have the resources or capital injections to scale up in an industrialization. So a very valid point, and something we discussed quite in depth. Now with the SADC Industrialization Week kicking off in Durban as well, this discussion will be continued as well. And we're looking forward to engagements on a regional level, apart from South Africa in general as well, to see how we can maximize a very underutilized industry.
What are some of the answers? How to maximize an underutilized industry? How do we bridge the gap from idea to execution? How long must we continue to talk about it?
So one of the main resolutions, and there were a few key resolutions that came from the Lekgotla in discussions between entities in the defense industry, public sectors, public departments, and also some on ministerial and director general level as well, was that the driving force behind utilizing a defense industry in South Africa to its maximum potential is in promoting export sales, and through that process create high-value jobs that adds value back into the country as well. So some of that, for example, is just a reformation or confirmation of existing incentive schemes. We discussed special economic zones that could add tremendous benefit in terms of scaling up a company and to accommodate the requirements for local and export markets. And another one that we also discussed was different funding or alternate funding models. And there's been a stigma around the commercial banking sector specifically that they don't really want to fund defense-related activities because of the lethality or the mortality of the nature of the business. However, we are seeing as defense and warfare activities across the globe differentiate themselves from one era to the next, the advancements of localized technologies in the form of electronics and augmented realities and things like that, and artificial intelligence, essentially means that there's a lot of dual-use applications that could potentially be utilized in this, meaning that security companies in agriculture and railway could also benefit from new technologies that are being developed. And although these technologies can be used in a defense environment, they're also applicable in other sectors as well.
That's an interesting base case from financial institutions, because you look at the capital markets right now, defense stocks are doing incredibly well. So that's quite an interesting point. Something that has captured the public imagination in South Africa, maybe we can touch on it. I do wonder what the conversation was. The contradiction, right? Defense policy versus defense funding. This is something that you touched on. The SANDF is looked upon to defend the republic, contribute to regional stability while supporting domestic security operations as well. It's being defunded with harrowing accounts also of what our military men and women have to contend with on the ground. What were some of the ideas that came out where this is concerned? Because while we look at hardware, which is also important, we have to look at the human capital as well.
Correct. I think one of the major things and one of the major themes in the SANDF's Journey to Greatness proposal that was accepted by the cabinet as well was a restructuring of the SANDF and its mandate. Yes, that is primarily tasked with protecting the sovereignty and the safety of citizens in South Africa, but there are many different tasks that it currently functions under that does not necessarily form part of its primary mandate. And if you restructure the SANDF and equip the soldiers and military men and women in the SANDF with the right tools, it essentially allows them to focus their attention on very serious domestic activities that we have within South Africa. For example, there is a huge drive on protecting South Africa's borders, and it's ongoing at the moment. We have an increased traffic and increased traffic around the maritime coastlines as well, which needs to be monitored and completely unmonitored at the moment. We have activities for illegal mining, gang violence, and a lot of crime activities domestically in South Africa. How the SANDF could assist in these domestic peacekeeping operations to stabilize the country essentially means a long-term economic growth because it becomes an attractive place for foreign investors, and countries essentially have a better sense of stability and reliability towards South Africa. So a lot of that has been discussed as well, and how we can maximize the value that the SANDF puts back into the safety and security alongside the sovereignty and regional stability as well. From what we discussed and what the outcomes were from the Slagotla, it sounds like the South African National Defense Force essentially is moving towards looking at domestic priorities first and then assisting with regional responsibilities, which I think is phenomenal.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Daniel, for your contribution this evening. Daniel du Plessis is president of Africa Milcor.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
This segment is brought to you by Omnia, your agriculture partner for more than 70 years. It's Tuesday, the 28th of July. Thank you very much for staying with us as we shift focus to our agri feature this evening. So the sugar industry is said to be at a crisis point due to cheap imports. That's according to the South African Cane Growers Association. In a statement, they note the imports flooding South Africa's market originate predominantly from countries like Brazil, India and Thailand, where growers benefit from generous state subsidies and integrated ethanol regimes that effectively allow surplus sugar to be offloaded onto global markets at prices far below what it costs South African growers to produce. Dr. Thomas Funke, CEO of the South African Cane Growers Association, he joins us now for more. Thank you very much, Doc, for your time this evening. So new data shows that sugar imports in the first 5 months of this year are nearly double what they were in the same period last year. Given that some 18 months ago you submitted an application as an industry to ITAC on this, how far have you come?
Yeah, good evening. Unfortunately, we don't know yet what the outcome of that application is and the investigation. We have heard quite recently that it has been finalized and will hopefully be making its way through the government channels for signature. But, you know, that is still speculation at this point in time. What we are seeing, as you quite rightly mentioned, is tons and tons of sugar being flooded into our market when in fact we are a surplus producer and we are being forced to export our sugar onto the global market.
Can we just expand on that? Because under South Africa's sugar industry agreement, sugar that is left unsold in the country must be exported. So South African sugar sales in the already distorted global sugar market, are they leading to further losses?
Absolutely. That is exactly right. So what happens is if there's a surplus of sugar in the South African market, we then, as an industry, don't refine the raw sugar and send it to the Durban and Maputo terminals to be exported onto the world market at very low prices. So just to give you an idea, the world price is currently sitting at 14 cents a pound. And if you convert that into rand, that's less than half of what a producer in South Africa would be receiving for sugar sold on the local market. So globally, there's a surplus of sugar, and it's basically trading at below the cost of production. I think it's only Brazil at this stage that probably can sell sugar at break-even prices onto the world market. Everyone else is battling.
Yeah, so a surplus of anything then impacts or directly impacts the price. What does that tell us more so about the local consumer? Do we see any of the benefit? Because usually the argument is that, well, it's a cheaper import.
Yeah, that would be nice. But what we're seeing is that the local price, so the price of the sugar being sold in South Africa from South African sugarcane is actually maintaining that local price. So what importers are doing is they're buying sugar in at very low prices, and then they're selling it at a markup into the South African market and thereby not benefiting the consumer. But I must add that a benefit like that, even if the price is a bit lower than the South African produced sugar, is just exporting jobs. So what happens is all that money is going to the likes of Brazil, Thailand and India, and funding their sugar industries rather than being circulated in the South African economy and supporting local jobs in rural areas where there are no other jobs available.
That just doesn't seem to make sense. You've been, as an association, fighting this good fight for a while now. What seems to be the delay, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I think originally when we submitted in October 2024, the process was stalled and took quite a while to get off the ground. And, you know, we're not pointing fingers at anyone, but I guess that's in government, you know, things take time and investigations are done, etc. And then BEVSA, the Beverage Association, we were told, submitted a counter application to ITAC just when ITAC was about, I think, in a process to evaluate the original application, which the sugar industry brought forward. And that also caused lengthy delays because now they were sitting with two applications and they had to decide what to do. And in January this year, both applications were then dismissed or not regarded. And ITAC, we're very grateful for that, launched its own investigation into the sugar duty or the dollar-based reference price in order to determine a number. And I guess that's what we're still waiting for. But in that time, we as an industry weren't able to take any price increases. So the sugar price has actually been stagnant for almost 2 years.
In the interim, what can we do? I mean, we as consumers, right? In terms of consumer awareness, will it go some way if I perhaps purchase South African brand as opposed to a different one where consumer education is concerned? Do we even know the difference, right? Because sometimes you don't even flip back to see where it's from. You're just like, oh, 15 Rand versus 23 Rand. Okay, I'll go with 15 Rand. So, I mean, this has repercussions more so when you talk about the sugar industry possibly going on its knees. It's something we can ill afford as a country, especially given our unemployment rates. Is there something I can do? Is there something Ezekiel can do? Is there something Kanya can do in the choices that we make?
Absolutely. And we encourage everyone to do exactly what you have said. Turn that packet over and make sure that it says produced in South Africa. So again, here one has to be very careful. Importers are also getting clever with the wording. They say packed in South Africa, even though the origin of that sugar may be Brazil, and they try and mislead the consumer. So important to make sure it says produced in South Africa. But we always say the safest is still to go to one of the South African brands. One of the retailers is also very strong in buying South African sugar, and you can also see that on the back of the packet. So we really encourage that the consumer, when they make that choice of buying South African sugar, make sure it's produced in South Africa, not just packed in South Africa.
Thank you very much, Doc, for your contribution this evening. Dr. Thomas Funke is CEO of the South African Cane Growers Association. This segment was brought to you by Omnia, your harvest, our greatest achievement.
In farming, success rarely happens by chance. But when I look ahead and surround myself with the right expertise, I feel confident in my ability to succeed.
At Omnia, we're not just a fertilizer supplier. With a holistic approach built on science, data-driven insights, and experience, we support you throughout the entire season. Your harvest is our greatest achievement.
When I partner with Omnia, I can grow with confidence.
Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
Africa.
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 If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzile Ramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
And that's it from the SAFM Market Update team with MoneyWeb. Thank you very much for choosing us. Remember, if you missed any of our stories, you can head on over to our website. That's www.moneyweb.co.za. Greg Hose is standing by with you, your latest news update. Have yourselves a magic evening further. Bagaitshu. Pulakyo.